Homodias, A Brief History of Tomorrow. Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Like every other source of authority, feelings have their shortcomings. Humanism assumes that each human has a single authentic inner self. But when I try to listen to it, I often encounter either silence or a cacophony of contending voices. In order to overcome this problem, humanism has upheld not just a new source of authority, but also a new method for getting in touch with authority and gaining true knowledge. In medieval Europe, the chief formula for knowledge was knowledge equals scriptures times logic. If we want to know the answer to some important question, we should read scriptures and use our logic to understand the exact meaning of the text. For example, scholars who wish to know the shape of the earth scan the Bible looking for relevant references. One pointed out that in Job 38:13, it says that God can take hold of the edges of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it. This implies, reasoned the pundit, that because the earth has edges of which we can take hold, it must be a flat square. Another sage rejected this interpretation, calling attention to Isaiah 40:22, where it says that God sits enthroned above the circle of the earth. Isn't that proof that the earth is round? In practice, that meant that scholars sought knowledge by spending years in schools and libraries, reading more and more text, and sharpening their logic so they could understand the text correctly. The scientific revolution proposed a very different formula for knowledge. Knowledge equals empirical data times mathematics. If we want to know the answer to some question, we need to gather relevant empirical data and then use mathematical tools to analyze the data. For example, in order to gauge the true shape of the Earth, we can observe the Sun, the Moon, and the planets from various locations across the world. Once we have amassed enough observations, we can use trigonometry to deduce not only the shape of the Earth, but also the structure of the entire solar system. In practice, that means that scientists seek knowledge by spending years in observatories, laboratories, and research expeditions, gathering more and more empirical data and sharpening their mathematical tools so they could interpret the data correctly. The scientific formula for knowledge led to astounding breakthroughs in astronomy, physics, medicine, and countless other disciplines. But it had one huge drawback. It could not deal with questions of value and meaning. Medieval pundits could determine with absolute certainty that it is wrong to murder and steal, and that the purpose of human life is to do God's bidding, because scriptures said so. Scientists could not come up with such ethical judgments. No amount of data and no mathematical wizardry can prove that it is wrong to murder. Yet, human societies cannot survive without such value judgments. One way to overcome this difficulty was to continue using the old medieval formula alongside the new scientific method. When faced with a practical problem, such as determining the shape of the earth, building a bridge, or curing a disease, we collect empirical data and analyze it mathematically. When faced with an ethical problem, such as determining whether to allow divorce, abortion, and homosexuality, we read scriptures. This solution was adopted to some extent by numerous modern societies, from Victorian Britain to 21st century Iran. However, humanism offered an alternative. As humans gained confidence in themselves, a new formula for attaining ethical knowledge appeared. Knowledge equals experiences times sensitivity. If we wish to know the answer to any ethical question, we need to connect to our inner experiences and observe them with the utmost sensitivity. In practice, that means that we seek knowledge by spending years collecting experiences and sharpening our sensitivity so we could understand these experiences correctly. What exactly are experiences? They are not empirical data. An experience is not made of atoms, molecules, proteins, or numbers. Rather, an experience is a subjective phenomenon that includes three main ingredients: sensations, emotions, and thoughts. At any particular moment, my experience comprises everything I sense, heat, pleasure, tension, etc., every emotion I feel, love, fear, anger, etc., and whatever thoughts arise in my mind. And what is sensitivity? It means two things. Firstly, paying attention to my sensations, emotions, and thoughts. Secondly, allowing these sensations, emotions, and thoughts to influence me. Granted, I should not allow every passing breeze to sweep me away. Yet I should be open to new experiences and permit them to change my views, my behavior, and even my personality. Experiences and sensitivity build up one another in a never-ending cycle. I cannot experience anything if I have no sensitivity, and I cannot develop sensitivity unless I undergo a variety of experiences. Sensitivity is not an abstract aptitude that can be developed by reading books or listening to lectures. It is a practical skill that can ripen and mature only by applying it in practice. Take tea, for example. I start by drinking very sweet ordinary tea while reading the morning paper. The tea is little more than an excuse for a sugar rush. One day, I realized that between the sugar and the newspaper, I hardly taste the tea at all. So I reduced the amount of sugar, put the paper aside, close my eyes, and focus on the tea itself. I begin to register its unique aroma and flavor. Soon, I find myself experimenting with different teas, black and green, comparing their exquisite tangs and delicate bouquets. Within a few months, I drop the supermarket labels and buy my tea at Harrods. I develop a particular liking for a Pandadong tea from the mountains of Yan in Sichuan province, made from leaves of tea trees fertilized by the dung of panda bears. That's how, one cup at a time, I hone my tea sensitivity and become a tea connoisseur. If in my early tea drinking days you had served me Pandadong tea in a Ming Dynasty porcelain goblet, I would not have appreciated it much more than builder's tea in a paper cup. You cannot experience something if you don't have the necessary sensitivity, and you cannot develop your sensitivity except by undergoing a long string of experiences. What's true of tea is true of all other aesthetic and ethical knowledge. We are not born with a ready-made conscience. As we pass through life, we hurt people and people hurt us. We act compassionately and others show compassion to us. If we pay attention, our moral sensitivity sharpens and these experiences become a source of valuable ethical knowledge about what is good, what is right, and who I really am. Humanism thus sees life as a gradual process of inner change leading from ignorance to enlightenment by means of experiences. The highest aim of humanist life is to fully develop your knowledge through a large variety of intellectual, emotional, and physical experiences. In the early 19th century, Wilhelm von Humboldt, one of the chief architects of the modern education system, said that the aim of existence is a distillation of the widest possible experience of life into wisdom. He also wrote that there is only one summit in life, to have taken the measure in feeling of everything human. This could well be the humanist motto. According to Chinese philosophy, the world is sustained by the interplay of opposing but complementary forces called yin and yang. This may not be true of the physical world, but it is certainly true of the modern world that has been created by the covenant of science and humanism. Every scientific yang contains within it a humanist yin, and vice versa. The yang provides us with power, while the yin provides us with meaning and ethical judgments. The yang and yin of modernity are reason and emotion, the laboratory and the museum, the production line and the supermarket. People often only see the yang and imagine that the modern world is dry, scientific, logical, and utilitarian, just like a laboratory or a factory. But the modern world is also an extravagant supermarket. No culture in history has ever given such importance to human feelings, desires, and experiences. The humanist view of life as a string of experiences has become the founding myth of numerous modern industries, from tourism to art. Travel agents and restaurant chefs do not sell us flight tickets, hotels, or fancy dinners. They sell us novel experiences. Similarly, whereas most pre-modern narratives focused on external events and actions, modern novels, films, and poems often revolve around feelings. Greco-Roman epics and medieval chivalric romances were catalogues of heroic deeds, not feelings. One chapter told how the brave knight fought a monstrous ogre and killed him. Another chapter recounted how the knight rescued a beautiful princess from a fire-spitting dragon and killed him. A third chapter narrated how a wicked sorcerer kidnapped the princess, but the knight pursued the sorcerer and killed him. No wonder that the hero was invariably a knight rather than a carpenter or a peasant, for peasants performed no heroic deeds. Crucially, the heroes did not undergo any significant process of inner change. Achilles, Arthur, Roland, and Lancelot were fearless warriors with a chivalric worldview before they set out on their adventures, and they remained fearless warriors with the same worldview at the end. All the ogres they killed and all the princesses they rescued confirmed their courage and perseverance, but ultimately taught them little. The humanist focus on feelings and experiences, rather than deeds, transformed art. Wordsworth, Dostoevsky, Dickens, and Zola cared little for brave knights and derring do, and instead described how ordinary people and housewives felt. Some people believe that Joyce's Ulysses represents the apogee of this modern focus on the inner life rather than external actions. In 260,000 words, Joyce describes a single day in the life of the Dubliners Stephen Dedalus and Leopold Bloom, who over the course of the day do, well, nothing much at all. Few people have actually read all of Ulysses, but the same principles underpin much of our popular culture too. In the United States, the series Survivor is often credited or blamed for turning reality shows into a craze. Survivor was the first reality show to make it to the top of the Nielsen ratings, and in 2007, Time magazine listed it among the 100 greatest TV shows of all time. In each season, 20 contenders in minimal swimsuits are isolated on some tropical island. They have to face all kinds of challenges, and each episode they vote out one of the members. The last one left takes home $1 million. Audiences in Homeric Greece and the Roman Empire or in medieval Europe would have found the idea familiar and highly attractive. 20 challengers go in, only one hero comes out. Wonderful! A Homeric prince, a Roman patrician, or a crusader knight would have thought to himself as he sat down to watch. Surely we're about to see amazing adventures, life and death battles, and incomparable acts of heroism and betrayal. The warriors will probably stab each other in the back or spill their entrails for all to see. What a disappointment. The backstabbing and entrail spilling remain just a metaphor. Each episode lasts about an hour. Out of that, 15 minutes are taken up by commercials for toothpaste, shampoo, and cereals. 5 minutes are dedicated to incredibly childish challenges, such as who can throw the most coconuts into a hoop, or who can eat the largest number of bugs in 1 minute. The rest of the time, the heroes just talk about their feelings. He said, she said, and I felt this, and I felt that. If a crusader knight had really sat down to watch Survivor, he would probably have grabbed his battle axe and smashed the TV out of boredom and frustration. Today we might think of medieval knights as insensitive brutes. If they lived among us, we would send them to a therapist who might help them get in touch with themselves. This is what the Tin Man does in The Wizard of Oz. He walks along the yellow brick road with Dorothy and her friends, hoping that when they get to Oz, the great wizard will give him a heart, while the scarecrow wants a brain and the lion wants courage. At the end of their journey, they discover that the great wizard is a charlatan and he cannot give them any of these things. But they discover something far more important. Everything they wish for is already within themselves. There is no need of some godlike wizard in order to obtain sensitivity, wisdom, or bravery. You just need to follow the yellow brick road and open yourself to whatever experiences come your way. Exactly the same lesson is learned by Captain Kirk and Captain Jean-Luc Picard as they travel the galaxy in the Starship Enterprise, by Huckleberry Finn and Jim as they sail down the Mississippi, by Wyatt and Billy as they ride their Harley Davidsons in Easy Rider, and by countless other characters in myriad other road movies who leave their hometown in Pennsylvania or perhaps New South Wales, travel in an old convertible or perhaps a bus, pass through various life-changing experiences, get in touch with themselves, talk about their feelings, and eventually reach San Francisco, or perhaps Alice Springs, as better and wiser individuals. That's it for today. I create a lot of content. I run a debating podcast, I write stories, I film videos with a drone, and I run many other projects too. If you'd like to stay informed of things I do, sign up to my private newsletter. It's free. Head to bit.ly/newslettersebastian, all attached and in lowercase. Thank you for listening.